Hello, this is Monica Reinagle, and you're listening to the Nutrition Diva podcast. Welcome. When the U.S. economy and society abruptly shut down in March 2020 due to a global pandemic, food shortages were common as supply chains temporarily collapsed. For example, most of the beef and the pork sold in the U.S. is processed in just a handful of huge plants. And when a COVID-19 outbreak shut just one or two of them down, retail outlets quickly ran out of meat, and a shortage of long-haul truckers made things even worse. Fortunately, food manufacturers and distributors recovered remarkably quickly, implementing incredibly effective safety protocols that allowed them to restore and maintain a highly functional food distribution system throughout the pandemic. However, the early days of the pandemic revealed a surprising vulnerability in our food supply network. The U.S. is a large country, both in population and in territory, and yet our food system is highly centralized. It's also highly efficient. That's one of the reasons our food costs are among the lowest in the industrialized world. One way the food industry boosts efficiency is through various agricultural technologies that increase the yield or the output of every square acre that we farm. Another is economy of scale. It's more cost-effective for one farmer or company to farm 1,000 acres than it is for 10 farmers to farm 100 acres each. And another way that we keep costs down is to reduce redundancies in the networks that supply, transport, and sell our food to us. But another word for redundancy is backup. And when a system has no redundancies or no backup systems, that entire system becomes only as strong as its weakest link. When our national food systems broke down temporarily, many people sought out new relationships with local growers and suppliers. Participation in community-sponsored agriculture, where people buy shares in small local farms in exchange for a weekly box of whatever's being harvested that week, shot up. And small farmers and wholesale vendors quickly set up programs to deliver meat, dairy, and produce directly to consumers' doorsteps. A local food economy sprang to life. And one of the lessons that many people drew from the pandemic was that a less centralized food supply and delivery system would be more resilient when things go awry, and that the benefits of some redundancy would outweigh the costs of the reduced efficiency. But while the local food movement may have gotten a big boost from the coronavirus crisis, it's been around for a long time, and one of the chief articles of faith among so-called locavores is that eating local reduces the carbon footprint of our consumption and is therefore more sustainable. But you know what? It's always wise to test these sorts of assumptions. Just because something seems totally logical doesn't always mean that it's true. European researchers Alexander Stein and Fabian Santini just published a fascinating paper on the sustainability of local food systems. In the political discussion, they write, the promotion of local food systems and short supply chains is sometimes presented as a means to increase the resilience of the food system, and it's also suggested as a means to improve the environmental footprint of the food system. End quote. So in their paper, they've reviewed the scientific literature on the environmental, the social, and the economic aspects of sustainability, and they reach some surprising conclusions. First off, is eating local actually easier on the environment? When consumers try to eat local, they often focus on how far their food has to travel from its source to their plates. You might remember a popular book called The 100-Mile Diet, which exemplified this approach. Barbara Kingsolver's best-selling Animal Vegetable Miracle is another example. And one assumption behind this trend is that eating locally will lower the carbon footprint of our diets. However, this is not necessarily the case. For one thing, shipping large quantities of foods in cargo ships or trains may actually burn less fossil fuel than transporting the same amount of food across much shorter distances in hundreds of small trucks. And now, just consider thousands of consumers driving to farms one by one in their cars to pick up their local food. This thinking also assumes that transporting food is the only or even the primary factor in how much carbon is emitted in the production of that food. But in fact, Food production can produce a lot of greenhouse gases prior to this final leg of the journey. In fact, Stein and Santini conclude that the carbon footprint of your diet depends a lot more on what types of foods you choose than it does on how many miles they travel to reach your plate. As a rule, plant foods are less carbon intensive than animal foods. But the same crops can have vastly different carbon footprints depending on the farming methods that are used. Also, highly processed foods are more carbon intensive than minimally processed foods. So theoretically, a highly processed plant-based food could potentially rival a minimally processed animal food in terms of carbon footprint. Obviously, reducing the carbon footprint of your diet involves much more than just eating local. Eating more minimally processed and more plant-based foods is at least as important. But do local food systems protect food security? Although disruptions in the food supply chain revealed vulnerabilities of our overly centralized food system, an exclusively local food system is not necessarily going to be more resilient. An urban region, for example, may not be able to produce enough food to feed its local population, while a more rural area can produce far more than its population can consume. And different areas of the country also differ widely in their growing conditions, which is why it makes a lot more sense to grow lettuce in Southern California, wheat in Nebraska, and citrus fruit in Florida, than it would to try to grow all three of these things in all three locations. In addition, a disaster impacting regional food production is actually much more likely than what we just experienced, which affected every region of the United States, indeed of the globe, at once. And finally, because local food systems are not always the most efficient or the most cost-effective, eating local is sometimes out of reach for the poor or the food insecure and remains the privilege of the relatively affluent. A diversity of food sources, including both regional and national supply chains, might be the most resilient food system, as well as the best way to ensure food security. Now, Stein and Santini did find evidence to support the idea that local food systems can make our communities stronger. When consumers buy from local growers, they're more likely to have a personal connection to them, and this fosters a greater awareness of the value of the work involved in producing our food, as well as the challenges. Participants in the local food system may be more invested in protecting the local environment and their communities, and local food systems can also create local jobs and support the local economy. But keep in mind that for the farmer, selling locally is not always the best deal. Sometimes they can make a better living selling their crops into a national or even an international marketplace. I think Stein and Santini have done us all a service simply by taking a closer look at this intuitive notion that eating locally must be more sustainable. As they conclude in their paper, local food cannot simply be equated with sustainable food. It neither can ensure food security, nor does it necessarily have a lower carbon footprint. In terms of social sustainability, local food systems are not necessarily more resilient, but they can contribute to rural development and a sense of community. Clearly, local farmers play an important role in our food system and in our communities. But there's a lot more to building a sustainable, resilient, and equitable food system than simply patronizing our local farmers' markets. So what do you think? Drop me a line at nutrition@quickanddirtytips.com or come visit me on the Nutrition Diva Facebook page. If you'd like to read the entire paper that I've been discussing today, I've included a link in the show notes, which you'll find at quickanddirtytips.com. The Nutrition Diva Show is written and researched by me, Monica Reinagle. It's edited by Beata Santora. Our producer is Nathan Sems. And our team at Macmillan Audio also includes Michelle Margulis, Emily Miller, Claire Freeman, and our director, Kathy Doyle. Thanks so much for listening, and remember to eat something good for me.